The following program is another in a series of discussions of national problems and was heard at home on the Chicago Roundtable of the Air. The United States Armed Forces Radio Service takes pleasure in presenting the question, should wage rates be increased? And now here is your mediator, Mr. Neil Jacoby.
To analyze the issues about wage policy, the Roundtable is departing today from its usual procedures. First, we shall hear a 5-minute statement by a labor union official supporting wage increases. Then, a 5-minute statement by a business executive will present the case against wage increases. These statements will be followed by a discussion between Boris Shishkin, economist for the American Federation of Labor, Raleigh W. Stone, professor of industrial relations in the School of Business of the University of Chicago, and myself. For the first statement, in behalf of wage increases, we take you now to Philadelphia to present Robert K. Lamb, legislative representative and economist for the United Steelworkers of America. Mr. Lamb.
To rephrase the question, to read, why labor should ask for wage increases. A widespread flood of inspired propaganda has told the American people that today's spiraling price levels are caused by wage increases. We are told, therefore, that labor's course should now be to abandon further wage demands and let prices level off. I suggest that we study the record following World War I. That tragic experience, culminating in the crash of 1929, produced the heartache, the bread lines, soup kitchens, and apple salesmen of the early 30s. Our people were, many of them, starving. Millions ill-fed and ill-clothed, without the money to buy food and clothing, while farmers and clothing manufacturers could not sell their products because the people lacked purchasing power. This prostrating depression was preceded by a boom, which saw more and more money going into the coffers of the few and less money into the hands of the American people, until, with catastrophic swiftness, came the breaking point. Between 1924 and 1929, average hourly earnings in 25 manufacturing industries only advanced from 56 or under 5%, less than a half cent per year. During the same time, manufacturing production rose about 34%. Output per man hour increased 35%, and profits rose 62%. Are we headed in the same direction today? Look at the record. Look first at average hourly earnings of workers. In January 1946, in manufacturing industries, the figure was between $1 and $1.01. By September 1946, and despite the much heralded 18.5 cent increase, these earnings for the same group of workers stood at $1.12 and 3/10 cents. Between January and September 1946, the cost of living rose 12.4%. The workers' earnings in September 1946 were therefore equivalent to 99.9 cents back in January. Preliminary reports before the president's removal of price controls indicated that we may expect by the end of 1946 to see prices as much as 24 or 25% above the April 1945 level. Now, as to the rise in manufacturing costs produced by these wage increases, as compared with wholesale prices. From April 1945 through August 1946, average hourly earnings rose 6%. According to a Federal Trade Commission study made in 1940, labor costs are roughly 25% of manufacturing costs. Therefore, a 6% increase in hourly earnings meant no more than a 2% rise in the cost of production. Yet wholesale prices of manufactured products during this 1945-46 period rose 25% or 23% more than the rise in the cost of production due to these wage increases. Who benefited from this upward spurt in prices? Look at profit levels. For the second quarter of 1946, the Federal Reserve Board, surveying some 600-odd industrial corporations, reported profits 18% above those for the equivalent period of 1945 and 37% above those for the equivalent period in the war years 1942 to 1945. estimated profits before taxes for all manufacturing corporations will run in 1947, almost five times the 1936 to 1939 average, and approximately 20% above the scandalously high wartime levels. Consider further the fact that practically all price controls have now been wiped out, and we can realize the dangerously high level of prospective profits for next year. In calling these profit levels dangerous, I am stating an economic problem and not a moral judgment. The 1929 crash showed that when profits go up and up, while the purchasing power of the nation goes down, the breaking point is soon reached where the people do not have the money to buy the products held by the profiteers. After World War II, we have already gone far down this dangerous road. We need to reestablish a balance within our economic structure. The question is whether workers should sit by and watch the prices rise and watch their ability to feed and clothe their families dwindle day by day. The question involves the health and welfare of the 50 million wage and salaried workers of America. But the question we are discussing also involves our entire economic structure. If labor heeds the advice to sit by and make no effort to secure a substantial wage increase, then labor would itself be contributing to that widening gap between prices and profits on the one hand and the people's purchasing power on the other, which spells ultimate disaster for the entire nation, for workers, farmers, and even for the employers. A demand by labor for a substantial wage increase now is not merely a humane necessity. It is economically imperative.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb, for your vigorous statement of the case for wage increases. Continuing this roundtable discussion of the question, should wage rates be increased, we now present a statement of the argument against wage increases. We take you now to Detroit and present Frank Rising, General Manager of the Automotive and Aviation Parts Manufacturers Association. Mr. Rising.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, of course the story you have just heard is full of the same kind of fallacies that it was last year. The case against substantial wage increases at this time is far stronger than that for the affirmative. Briefly, the case against substantial and universal increases for the people represented by the labor unions is this. First, prices in many lines already are too high for many of our people to reach, and the kind of wage increases forced by the big unions last year, with no regard for productivity, will further advance the cost of goods to the consumer. Wages is really a term which describes a price, the price of labor. Without improving the content of the package of labor which is sold, the unions have jacked up the price of labor. Now we hear that they want to do the same thing again, sell the same commodity, or less of it, for a still higher price. This would be ruinous to our hopes of restoring the orderly processes of our economy and reaching stable conditions. The reason advanced for these demands is that the cost of living has gone up. Most certainly it has gone up. Every one of us knows that. And most of us know that the reason it went up so rapidly during 1946 was that the spokesmen for organized labor were short-sighted. They put the cart before the horse with the claim that if purchasing power was high, production would just naturally be high, too. They made another bad mistake, and so did the government. Enforcing the wages of a minority up to an artificially high point in relation to all other wages and salaries, they left a great part of our people behind. Today it is still true that more than half of our gainfully employed have had no wage increase since VJ Day. How is it possible, then, for them to buy the products made by the favored few of the aristocracy of labor, which did get the substantial wage increases? Now we are confronted with a great problem. we have advanced the price of a basic commodity, labor, in some of our industries, and we have put that price too high for other people to meet. We can bring it down only by improving the quality of goods we get for the price. In other words, by increasing productivity per man for the same wages. To do anything else is to court disaster. Most people sense this. The pronounced swing away from the false prophets during our recent election is evidence of this feeling. People don't quite know what is wrong, but they do know that we have been led astray by slogans and sophistry. Further, the cost of living argument will not hold water. The cost of living, jacked up by handouts to selfish and short-sighted minorities, was bound to rise if we were forced to pay more for the same or less work. If we refuse to repeat this mistake, we will see the cost of living decline slowly but steadily as people turn again to sanity and productive pursuits. We can see it already in the price of meat. And remember, we were told that meat costs would go through the ceiling. This cannot happen so long as we rest our faith in the good sense of the consumer. To sum up, the price of labor is one of the prices which we have to watch. We all have to pay it. We are entitled to get value received. And in too many cases, we have been shortchanged as the short-sighted spokesmen for the unions have insisted on gouging the public. Don't forget, the clamorous group led by organized unions is a minority, a loud minority, but a minority nevertheless. We have favored them with substantial increases only recently, and all of the rest of us have suffered from the fact that an equal amount of work failed to match the increases. The best reason for not going through this horrible mistake again is simply this. We have just been through it. We are not discussing the problem in a vacuum today. We know what the results are when we adopt fallacious and misleading measurements, when we let emotion and self-interest overcome reason and logic. There is no logical way out of our problem except to go to work. That is the sure way and the only way for us to reach a position of stability and of a prosperous high standard of living for all of our people. With large production will come reduced prices, and with lower prices will come larger purchasing and still larger demand for production. Let's end this nonsense and get the horse in front of the cart so that we can pull the load as it should be pulled.
Thank you, Mr. Rising, for a full and equally vigorous statement against wage rate increases at the present time. Well, gentlemen, we have heard some sharp differences of opinion. Mr. Lamb has said that wage rate increases are necessary to prevent recession and to compensate workers for increases in cost of living. Business profits, he says, are large. And prices have risen to the point where the last increases in wages can readily be absorbed by profits. Rising, on the other hand, has argued that prices have already come up so high that the market for goods is being choked off by the inability of many people to buy goods. And he says further that if we have more wage rate increases at this time, the higher prices will make the situation worse and drive us into a recession. He calls upon labor for increased productivity and stable wage rates. Well, now, Yul Shishkin is economist for the American Federation of Labor. Hugh Stone, professor of industrial relations in the School of Business, the University of Chicago, I'm sure have views on these points. And without at all confining yourselves to the arguments that have been advanced by Lamb and Rising, I'd like to ask you, Shishkin, what is your general approach to the problem should wages be increased?
I don't think, Jacoby, that wages should be increased just for the heck of it. I think they should be increased for a good and sufficient reason. And I think, as we look at the problem today, that there is a very good, a very sufficient, and very vital reason why, by and large, wages should be increased. I think the most important reason is that we are on the verge of a complete transition to peacetime, and that never in peacetime did we reach the level of full absorption of our productive capacity. And unless wages are substantially increased, by and large, I say, not perhaps in every case, but generally speaking, I think the path toward the depression is inevitable, and I think we're right on the verge of it now. As for the cost of living, I think that there are many wage rates that don't compensate workers for the cost of living increases that have already taken place. And for in those cases, the adjustments that are to wipe out those deficits in real wages will have to be made. But I don't think that wages should be tied up to the cost of living alone. What do you say, Stone?
Well, I disagree categorically with Shiskin. I think it would be a calamity to have further wage increases at the present time. The whole economic system is in a condition of highly inflationary, in my judgment, so that wage increases would cause further price inflation. And secondly, I think that our wage structure is highly unbalanced. Some parts of the economy, many groups of workers, are not in position to buy the products produced by high-cost labor in other areas. So that if we were to have a wage increase, we'd produce further distortion, which, as a long-run matter, would bring about a depression, but the immediate effect would be a further price inflation, which would not be good for any of us.
I don't think that I agree with Stone in his assumption that whenever a wage increase is granted, that a proportionate increase in prices need to take place. It doesn't need to happen, and it has not happened in some instances in which the competitive situation has prevented it. What we have seen, a spectacle in which the wage increase has been used as an argument for disproportionate price increases, whereas the actual wage costs have been reduced, we've had a very vast increases in prices. Take the steel price that we just heard on the discussion. In the case of labor costs from 45 to 46, the labor cost per ton of steel was reduced $1, and yet the steel industry increased the price of steel $5 per ton on the argument that the labor costs that were induced by the wage raise they've given would justify and warrant an increase in steel price. Now, here are the facts that prove that the very arguments the steel industry has used don't stand up.
I'd like to ask you, gentlemen, to direct your question, your thoughts to this question. Should wage rates rise with the cost of living as a matter of principle? What do you say to that, Stone?
Well, I think it'd be highly desirable if wage rates did keep up with the cost of living. That'd be highly desirable for all parts of the economy, but I think it's impossible. Production is still far short of the total purchasing power available for spending. So it's simply impossible to have wages keep up entirely with the rising prices.
Well, what would happen, Stone?
How about the wages of professors, for example? As one professor, I know that my wage rise has not kept up with the cost. What do you say to that, Shishkin?
Well, I think that not only professors, but all teachers in the country have been facing the kind of an income that they are no longer able to teach. And I think that the uncommon teacher in the United States is now an example of what happens to the people that can't exercise their profession according to their skill. And I think that this is just one illustration of hundreds and thousands of occupations in which we have a complete dislocation in the wage structure in relation to the kind of a standard of living to which these people are entitled.
Here's another question. Less than a year ago, there was a general 18.5 cents an hour rise in the wage rate in leading manufacturing industries. We now see the prices of automobiles and refrigerators and other products coming up since price control has been abolished. Has the last round of wage increases yet been wholly passed on in the necessary price increases? And I use the word necessary as meaning price increases that will be necessary to establish a price at which these businesses can operate profitably over a long time.
But it seems to me highly obvious, Jacoby, that the last round of wage increases has not yet been fully passed along.
Just a few days ago, we got approximately a 20% rise in laundry prices here in Chicago. Telephone companies asking for a 20% increase in rates. The railroads will have to have an increase in rates if they don't go broke. And we know that the automobile and electrical industries, just to mention two, are not making profits. Any profit that they can possibly live on. So that these increases are simply passing along the last wage increase.
Of course, would you expect prices to rise then from this point, Stone, even if by some miracle wage rates should be frozen?
Yes, I expect to see further increase in prices, a very substantial increase above the present level.
What do you think, Shishkin, on that point?
Well, I think that Stone's facts are wrong. I think that the facts indicate that the largest proportionate price increases that have taken place are in just the areas in which the wage increases have not been granted at all, or to a very small extent, since the VJ Day on that round of wage increases that have been taking place. Of course, to say that the last round of wage increases amounted to 18.5% is not correct. We find that some 27% of the workers during that round received no increases, and that a great majority of them have increased much less, so that in the average, the wage increases have been only about 12%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But I think that the crucial issue that's involved here is whether or not we are pricing ourselves out of the market, whether the purchasing power that is necessary to maintain this market is going to be available. We have a clear indication today that in our reconversion goods, in our durable goods, refrigerators, radios, and all those, that the market is already disappearing, that people are no longer able to offer a future promise of purchase, and the production will begin to decline unless wages are put in proportion to prices.
There is no evidence, Shishkin, that there's any great piling up of inventories that are not sold. You can pick out a few spots, as you have, mention one or two items, and then you're through. Otherwise, the shelves are bare, and people are still waiting for production.
Well, that depends whose inventories. The shelves may be bare right now in November 1946 on some items, and yet you'll find that manufacturers' inventories are high. But I think that on the whole, the inventories problem is not a very serious problem, because if we do maintain a very high volume of production, I think that the inventories need to be high and that the pipelines need to be filled in order to maintain it. But the pipeline is not going to move these things out to the consumer if the consumer hasn't got anything to buy with, and the average housewife today knows that she has only money enough to buy the necessities.
Well, gentlemen, coming back to the question whether business profits are large enough to support higher wages at present prices, don't we have to recognize that the profit picture in business is a very spotty one, and that in the durable consumer goods industries, automobiles and electric home appliances, in general, we see the lowest profits or the largest losses, and those are precisely the industries where the wage rate, where the wage rates at the present time in manufacturing are the highest. Whereas in some of the other industries, such as textiles and food and paper, where wage rates are lower, we see profits that are fairly ample.
Well, in general, though, profit margins are exceedingly low, so that any significant increase in costs will force higher prices.
But profits after taxes are higher than they have ever been, actually, in any part of our peacetime economy. And I'm not quarreling with that particularly. The thing that I'm quarreling with is the way this question was put. It's production that supports both profits and wages, and not profits that support wages. The volume of production has to be maintained, and here again, I again come to the prospect that it's immediate in our hand of whether or not the purchasing power that is paid out in those wages and the proper share of workers in the production to which they contribute in terms of greater efficiency and higher productivity that they'll contribute to, and higher productivity because of technology, will be able to support, be translated into that purchasing power that will absorb that production. That's the question, gentlemen.
Well, Shishkin, how do you expect any increase in production when you already have full employment of all labor? There is no unemployment now. And furthermore, as you know, the elasticity of supply of labor is negative, so that higher wages produces less labor.
Well, of course, we are on the last step of our full employment. We have yanked out the tooth of war production, and there's nothing to fill that gap now. 80% decrease in federal spending for goods and services is a gap that we'll have to face. That's deflationary. There's been an awful lot of labor hoarding, and we are faced today with a situation in which the veterans that are still out of the labor market will be returning, and there will be no jobs for them or jobs offered at starvation levels.
There's one other point that seems important. The ability of businesses to pay higher wages without raising prices depends on labor productivity. Is that going to rise?
I think unquestionably it's going to rise. It's been held back by the kind of reshuffling that we've seen during the past year and a number of factors that are part of the reconversion process. At the same time, I think that the technology developed during the war is going to show up, and that the experience and skills that are ingrained now in the labor force, the application of the proper skills to proper jobs, are going to bring us to a point in which the productivity is going to rise very rapidly and will support the adjustments in wages.
That's the same kind of baloney that was dished out last year.
We were arguing a question of fact here, and we're not engaging in the epithets, and I'm sorry you brought down this discussion to that particular level. I think that the studies that have been made by the competent scientific researchers in this field have indicated and show a consensus of the scientific mind, which may not have penetrated in your courtyard yet, that the productivity on the basis of past experience is going to rise very rapidly and support higher wages.
However you cut it, it's still baloney.
You've answered the question, should wages be increased, quite differently. Shishkin answers that wages should be increased in order to compensate for the increases in the cost of living that have already occurred and to increase consumer spending power for the purposes of preventing recession. He says that the rise in productivity of labor will be large enough and rapid enough to support higher wages without damaging business profits. Stone answers that wages should not be increased now, mainly because the rise would force further price inflation. Wage increases would impose heavier inequitable burdens on people with fixed incomes who have already suffered greatly. Stone thinks that consumer buying power, far from needing a further increase through higher wages at the moment, is already excessive. Over a longer period of time, wage increases will force price increases to the point where the public will be unable to buy the products of a fully employed economy.
This has been another program in the Herd at Home series. Discussing the question of whether wage rates should be increased were Robert K. Lamb, legislative representative of the United Steelworkers of America, Frank Rising, general manager of the aviation parts manufacturers, Boris Shishkin, economist for the American Federation of Labor, Raleigh W. Stone, professor of industrial relations, University of Chicago, and Neil Jacoby, vice president of the University of Chicago. The opinions expressed were those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the War and Navy Departments. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.